We had a 40 horse on this puppy, a donation, and I'd never dared to throttle it up past 25% of maximum. Remember that a VW Bug has an engine with less than 30 horsepower. When you hit running speed in this zode, if the water's not too rough, the entire boat rises from the water. The only wet part is the screw. It's the ultimate Boston transportation. On land, there's the Omni, but all these slow cars get in the way. There's public transit, the T, but if you're in good shape, it's usually faster to walk. Bicycles aren't bad, but on water, nothing stops you, and there isn't anything important in Boston that isn't within two blocks of being wet. The harbor and the city are interlocked like wrestling squid, tentacles of water and land snaking off everywhere, slashed with bridges or canals. Speaking of entomology, one of my minor obsessions in a very slow documentary project is the relationship of humans to camel crickets, which, are you aware of camel crickets?
No, tell me more.
Okay, well, they're crickets that have a morphological resemblance to spiders that live in basements, and I swear there's a certain climate band. It's essentially in the United States within 100 miles of Interstate 64. So they have them in Missouri, in Kansas City. They have them in Virginia. They have them in Western Virginia. But people in New England don't know about them. And people in the Deep South don't seem to know about them. And you can Google this now. But they're kind of horrific looking. They look like sort of a cricket zombie. Like somebody stepped on a cricket and it like came back to life jerkily and then grew spider legs. And they and this is the thing I find fascinating about them, is that everyone who knows about them, unless they're actually insect scientists, kind of hates them. And also everyone swears that they will leap at your face if you see one. And they're like, oh yeah, they leap at your face. And my friend Ben Pajek, who's an actual entomologist, it's like, surely they don't leap at your face. That can't be the case. And I'm like, no, they do. They do. And so we've had interviews about, and I have a series of audio interviews I've done with people being sort of like, they leap at your face. They're crazy. They're so ugly. I saw one the size of a softball one time. You know, and then I have another series of interviews with scientists who are sort of like, it's very unlikely that leaping at the face would be a, although Ben, I was insistent enough upon it that Ben recanted a little bit and said, maybe it's possible that they have an adaptation to avoid predation, which is to turn and face the predator, which is something that predators don't expect. You know, so if you've ever seen like there's a certain genre of cat videos where cats like attack a big dog or attack an alligator, and the dog or the alligator runs away. And so, similarly to the, you know, cornered cat, maybe the camel crickets.
Or also, like, I love this idea that the camel cricket has somehow, through the course of evolution, discovered the principle of like, show the aggressor your face. You know, so it's just like there's a whole bunch of camel crickets out there that are just trying to be respected as persons.
Yeah, because, you know, an evolutionary adaptation does not need to have rational thought attached to it. So what it might feel is a deep sense of wanting to be known and understood.
Exactly.
As opposed to simply being like, that thing is really big. I'm going to leap at it in the hopes that it runs away, because otherwise it's going to step on me. I will say that if the adaptation is about scaring off potential predators, it certainly works with humans, because
it's a creepy looking thing. It's the reflectiveness of its carapace is not doing it any favors.
Yeah. And there's a kind of mottled quality to it. And then I think the other thing is that it's got six legs, but two of them have a kind of size and angularity that really put one in mind of a large, like a tarantula.
Yeah. Every single demon that shows up in a Miyazaki film has.
There you go. Well, and part of the reason I point this out is in the movie Parasite, there's a moment when they're in their flooded apartment, or even before then, there's a couple moments where camel crickets show up, but the translation is poor and it translates it as stink bug. But it's clearly a camel cricket. And first of all, you will note that Seoul, Korea is on the same latitude as I-64. So that fits with my hypothesis about the climate ban. And I love this. Yeah, so if I ever get to talk to Bong Joon-ho, I intend to ask him about what he thinks about Camel Cricket.
Because
he does use
him.
It as a foreshadow of like looming disaster.
And then like a few years later, you're going to end up in some magazine as he quotes like the strangest interview he ever did,
right,
where he like went into this interview being like, OK, I'm going to like talk about Parasite again. And you're like, did you know? Seoul is on the same latitude as
Charlottesville in Kansas City.
Charlottesville, Virginia. And did you know that camel cricket poorly translates to stink bug?
Yeah.
And he's good. And he will love you, I bet. It will be one of those things. He will remember you forever as the bizarre journalist.
I'll ask him, you know, if he oversaw the translation and if he'd like to know. They're also sometimes called cave crickets. And there are some people who refer to them as spider crickets, too, for obvious reasons.
I could see how that ended up happening. That does make sense.
Well, we're recording at least three different ways, I'm going to say hello, dear listener, and thanks for putting up with our talk about camel crickets and the sequel to Host and Parasite, whatever it might be. And welcome to Upper Middle Brow Episode 5. So we're doing an early, it's actually not technically the earliest Neal Stephenson novel. There was a book called The Big U, and there were a couple of other books that he wrote under an assumed name with his uncle. But this was kind of the first major novel associated with Neal Stephenson. It was not nearly as big of a hit as Snow Crash, Zodiac. And what year did it come out? 88, 89, something like that?
88.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So I was in middle
92
school.
92 for Snow Crash. And I think Diamond Age was 94, maybe 95.
Something like that. Yeah. And I would say Cryptonomicon was 98 or 99.
It's an amazing
number. And then you devote like
pages.
15 years to the Baroque cycle.
And writing the whole time. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so shall we do a plot recap for Zodiac?
I have a feeling that I am going to play the heel tonight.
Okay. I could see that.
I kind of have a similar feeling that you did to Snow Crash, where like, you know, there's a bunch of these opening chapters that like really could be gone. So my sort of like, if we were doing the plot summary, my summary of probably almost the first, 10 to 11 chapters, I'm going to retitle Sangamon Taylor Thinks He's a Badass.
Well, just for the record, I think Snow Crash is masterful.
Totally.
I think opening chapters are masterful. I was only pointing out that they're not strictly necessary from a plotting point of view.
And you're totally right.
Yeah. But that is not to say that they don't enrich the book tremendously.
Totally. And I'm in the same boat here. I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'll do the first few chapters, which is essentially we meet Sangamon Taylor, who works for Greenpeace. In this book has been retitled G. In the book, it's actually written G-E-E. Another one of those like jokes that Neal Stephenson just couldn't help himself out about. But in the first four or five chapters, we meet Sangamon Taylor and learn that he fancies himself a toxic Spider-Man who is committed to persecuting polluters worldwide, but specifically in Boston Harbor, unless he's called away to other areas of the Northeast. And by the end of chapter 5, we have learned a lot about his kind of modus operandi and how he got into this job and the people that he both works with and who he dislikes. And that really takes us up to the end of chapter 5, which is when he has lunch with Tom Akers, the diver, at the Vietnamese restaurant.
Okay.
Right before they head to Blue Hills, New Jersey, which I will kick over to you.
Yeah, and I think it maybe it'd just be useful to say that he's got a couple of methodologies, but a lot of what he spends his time doing is trying to catch industries in and around Boston, basically disgorging waste into the harbor or the nearby rivers. And he's trying to find physical evidence of that. And then he's trying to find ways of documenting that evidence and putting pressure on them to stop doing it. And he does it in a various, and he's also, he's a chemist by training too, which I think is important to understand. So he meets this diver at his favorite Vietnamese restaurant, and there's a certain amount of exposition, not unlike the robotic librarian in Snow Crash, where he's doing exposition, but it's under the guise of this diver is worried about being exposed to dioxins in his diving and also worried about his Agent Orange exposure. And Sangamon Taylor explains, well, it's really the same thing. Because it has to do with chlorine and fat, and it's sort of an exposition chapter disguised as two dudes having beer. There's also, one thing about this novel is Sangamon Taylor is very much a guy in his 20s, and that he has the constitution of a guy in his 20s. He has the emotional maturity of a guy in his 20s. He drinks a lot. He is not good at relationships. He has a lot of casual sex.
He has a real male myopia for just any gender that is not his.
Not in a malicious way, but in a sort of ignorant slash. I mean, he's very sort of like in the world that he is in and not particularly good at empathy or other people's feelings, but not in a malicious way, just in a sort of like arrogant dumbass sort of way, but also very smart person. So then I would say there is a little bit of plotting about what I think is the main plot of the novel in those first five chapters. But then we move to sort of the first side quest, which is is it Blue Point? Do I have or Blue Kills? Blue Kills side quest, which also sort of serves a few plotting things. It also sort of serves to give us kind of a taste of how G and Sangamon Taylor operate. And also I think it kind of fulfills there's a certain kind of heist movie and novel that where there's sort of like three heists, and the first is sort of like meet the crew and see how they work. And that's the Blue Kills section. And so basically what ST and his G friends are up to, they have a sailboat and they have some Zodiac rafts, and they discover this really long diffuser pipe that's being released by a company that I think is Swiss Dow, which he only refers to as the Swiss Bastards. And it's underwater. And so he and the diver basically come up with a very clever technical scheme for plugging all something like 150 holes in this pipe, and also turning that into a media event that embarrasses the chemical company, attracts the positive attention and negative attention of some law enforcement. Generally, it seems to go pretty well and gets good press. Oh, and also he starts having sex with one of his collaborators, Debbie. And that takes us back to Boston, and I'll let you take it over from there.
Yeah. In the screenwriting parlance, this is this section of the movie is fun and games.
And very much act one.
Yeah. Everything's going great.
Yeah. Yeah.
We get back to Boston. He goes on vacation. There is a very short vacation section. And again, just like my experience with Snow Crash, like I read this book after Snow Crash and I only read it once. So we're talking like Chris is 15. And I like my brain located the vacation like towards the end of the book. And so when I was like, whoa, what? It's here? Because I very, of course, as a 15-year-old boy, I remembered the scene of him having sex with Debbie in the tent at the rate of the waves crashing on the shore.
Very funny phrase, typical duck squeezer sex at one point, which given the place where you and I both worked at the same time was a phrase that I found a little bit resonant and amusing.
Totally. So he goes on vacation. He hates it. He's one of the things that we need to know about is that he's got a side project called Project Lobster. where he has befriended a bunch of Boston Harbor lobstermen. And he gets lobsters from them because lobsters tend to be bottom feeders. And as we learn in this book, whatever pollution is in the water will get concentrated in their livers. He is out on Spectacle Island trying to do some basically off-gassing of methane that is piling up underneath Spectacle Island, which is a large garbage dump. You don't really pick up too much why they're out there other than sort of general shenanigans. There's kind of this feeling that he wants to advertise that Boston Harbor is really dirty by setting off these flares on Boston Harbor.
Does he say that? I know it's true that it is better to burn methane than release it into the atmosphere because it is a greenhouse gas. And so even though it releases carbon when you burn it, carbon is actually much better than methane. But I don't know if he ever explains that.
Yeah, I mean, so, but when we're out on Spectacle Island, he bumps into some Satanists and gets into a row with them, ends up basically winning that round, throwing their gun into the harbor, and they kind of limp away with their tails between their legs. But in my notes, I wrote down something like, aha, we have hit our first major plot point.
It is the inciting incident, I think. Something like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it's a quarter of the way into the book.
It's one of the inciting incidents. And then unfortunately, we learn not too long after that, the inciting incident is like a red herring from their point of view. And you're like, oh, but it's okay. Let's see.
It does set him off on his particular quest, right? Even if his understanding of what's happening isn't quite right.
Exactly. Yeah, because he is worried now because the Satanists began harassing him and his now ex-girlfriend, Debbie, because they have broken up. He is he's being protective of Debbie and her roommate, Tanya, who is helping him out with Project Lobster. She misses a Project Lobster handoff, and it's because at first, he thinks that the Satanists have messed with her because he goes to the lab to check things out. And the Satanists have, in fact, broken into their lab and vandalized it. And we learn that that's not actually the problem. The problem is that Tanya has dissected one of the lobsters and discovered that it is basically full of PCBs. Like, so full of PCBs that, like, real, like, acute disease is possible, not long-term kind of like cancerous and things like that, but no, you are going to get poisoned and die within a certain amount of time. He even sees a guy with chloracne at a Red Sox game.
A symptom of PCB poisoning.
Yeah, which sounds disgusting. Like thousands of blackheads all over his skin.
So ST is convinced that there's some kind of big polluter in the harbor dumping PCBs, and he thinks it might be the Satanists, although he also has this counter theory that maybe they just overheard him talking about PCBs and thought that he said PCP, and that what they're actually doing is cooking PCP, and that's why they're messing with him. But they do start messing with him, including... killing and dismembering the cat that hangs out at his house, which is,
oh, I know, Scrounger.
Poor Scrounger. Like, oh. Yeah. And so he tries to gather evidence around a PCB hotspot in the harbor, and I don't remember exactly, but basically fails. He's not able to find any evidence of that, and he gets kind of burned out and frustrated, and he stops calling Debbie, who likes him and he likes her, but he's bad with relationships, so he kind of just, like, he's feeling bad, so he kind of shuts her out and decides he's going to go on a vacation, but his boss decides to talks him out of the vacation, instead sends him on side quest number two, Buffalo, which is like the second heist of the book. And this is a pretty fun heist where there is a chlorine factory in near Niagara Falls. And some G people there have discovered a pipe and it's kind of hard, but they figure out a way to plug it and doing a kind of creative media action. And, you know, there's some fun classic Stevenson writing at one point about the strobe light being left on all night, like burning permanently the U-Haul insignia into the security guard's retina, which is like could be right out of Snow Crash or, you know, there are these glimmers of the later Stevenson in moments. And it's a pretty fun heist. But again, one has a hard time understanding exactly how it advances the plot. But one of the things it does in the last chapter, I think, that we're considering is it gets ST invited to a board meeting of this chemical company where he then meets the CEO of Bio something or other, basically a company somehow affiliated potentially with the PCBs and potentially with the Satanists and potentially with his old buddy who's got a German name like Boomhauer or something like that. Do you remember the name?
Dolmacher.
Dolmacher. Yeah, there are a lot of German names in this book, I've noticed, too.
Yeah, who he re-christens Lumpy when he meets him for the first time and sort of revels in the fact that he has now assigned Dolmacher this pejorative nickname in his sort of yuppie circles for the rest of his life.
And Dolmacher's an old college frenemy who kind of, I think, likes ST and is trying to get to recruit him because he's a talented chemist to work for his bioengineering company. And so that the CEO of that company pops up in this board meeting and we don't really understand why. And the meeting ends kind of abruptly. And that's the end of our section, I think.
He does make contact with an assistant attorney general who he dubs Cohen. Mm-hmm. That will become more important later on. But at the moment, just sort of gets ends up in a little bit of a throwaway.
And makes contact with a native guy named Jim Grandfather, who also, mm-hmm. I think, will become important later, too, who plays a small bit role in heist number two. Or side
but
quest
I think that's our plot rundown.
My first question to you is, imagine that it is 1989 and you're the acquisitions editor for Stevenson's publisher. I'm not sure who that was.
Bantam.
Okay, Bantam. So you're the acquisitions editor and Zodiac has come out. It has done its run and it did not quite earn out, but almost, you know, like for people not in the know, not that I'm particularly in the know, but I believe the understanding in the publishing industry is when you get a book deal, you get an advance, you know, at the time it could have been $10,000-$15,000. Now it's anything from like $25,000 to millions of dollars. But I would say a typical advance for a first time author might be $50,000 or something like that. And if your sales, justify the advance, meaning that the royalties, according to your royalty share, you sell enough that the royalties would cover the advance, that's called earning out. And often that means they're going to give you another deal because they made money on your book. And that's a good sign. And if you don't earn out, often you don't get another deal because they took a chance on you and it didn't work out. And so, Chris, you're the acquisitions editor. This writer, Zodiac, is published. It almost earns out. It doesn't quite, but it only misses it by a couple thousand. Do you give Neal Stephenson another book deal?
This is a great question. This, we should start adding this question into our recurring questions. It's a hard question to answer because of what we know. So I'm trying to think of, you know, what I would be thinking of upon reading an author's debut novel and what I would be looking for. I mean, despite how I feel about the general total effect of this book, and I'm sure some of that is colored by what he goes on to do, I think that due to the just sheer verve of the sentences and his ability to sort of cascade forward no matter what, And his invention of a somewhat annoying and somewhat self-centered, but very good vehicle for plot main character, I would say yes.
Well, yeah, and the person in that position apparently also said yes, because we have Snow Crash.
Is it the same house? We should find out if it's the same house.
We should. Yeah, yeah. It's a good question. But somebody said yes. Yeah. But I don't know. Zodiac may have, you know, sold well too. I know it didn't sell as well as Snow Crash. It wasn't a breakthrough hit. But yeah, and I would hope that in that role I would make the same decision, and I would worry that I wouldn't because of the pressures of earning money in the publishing industry and a kind of conservatism and there, it's clear to me from reading this book that there are flashes of brilliance, and it's clear to me this is a talented writer. It's also kind of a mess of a book in many respects, although I enjoyed it, and I actually enjoyed it a little bit more than I expected to reading it again. And it's less of a mess than I remember it being, but it is nowhere near the brilliance and the tightness I think of Snow Crash or some of the later novels. Yeah.
His work sort of lifts off into Snow Crash into this kind of fully realized thing. Hmm. I think in a lot of ways, this is a very typical debut novel. It is dutiful. It is trying really hard at the thing it's trying to do. It's earnest. You know, once you described to me, it's funny, this might be one of those things where maybe you don't remember this at all. And it's become something that I return to very often. You described to me as a successful country song as doing one thing all the time.
Hmm.
And I have used that in so many other contexts where we're really being true to a simple idea is the whole reason you're doing the thing. Mm-hmm. And to get outside of that structure can really screw up the whole shooting match. Hmm. Like when you're making an omelet, just make a fucking omelet. Like an omelet should be about an omelet, and that's it. It really even shouldn't be too much about what you put in it. Right. And I think that Zodiac is the same thing. The Mysteries of Pittsburgh is another debut novel that also is dutiful and doesn't quite have the like takeoff of the later books. But yeah, this is a great first novel.
Yeah.
We both would be ecstatic to write something like this.
I know. I would dream of writing a novel this good on my first attempt or on any attempt. Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you want to ask your next question?
Yeah, I think it passes into it. This book really got me thinking about how do we determine the upper part of upper middle brow, other than it's something that CKB and JPD like, which is a kind of bias that I think we can acknowledge and leave behind. But also it still should be sitting there, or we should at least voice it that, a lot of what we think is upper middle brow is going to reflect our tastes. I tried to read this book from that lens of looking for, okay, the upper part of upper middle brow, we have kind of talked about the literary aspects of it, and the crafting of it. And in some cases, as we've talked about some of the other books, we've read passages that for both of us, the writing has kind of ascended into that literary place, or the intricacy of the plotting has done something where we're like, oh yeah, okay, this is an upper middle brow book. I don't know for me if this book is an upper middle brow book. And I'm wondering, my question for you is, what in this book do you find to be upper?
Well, okay. I have a couple of answers, but before I answer, just one question is, what's at stake for you in that question?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about it that way. I don't know if there is something. It was interesting to me because as I was reading the book, I kept being like, I don't find anything really like literary about this or upper. I find it very readable and I am enjoying it and I'm turning the pages. But then I was like, okay, how do I feel about devices of characterization, of language, of diction? And I couldn't find too much. And I was like, okay, am I reading a witty page turner that has a kind of like, yeah, like fuck the man kind of nature to it that is appealing to me?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you then another version of that. Sorry, I'm delaying answering to your questions.
That's okay.
But I guess maybe part of what I was asking is it important to you as we conceive of this podcast that every work we talk about counts as upper middle book?
No, because I think that there are going to be moments like this where it's interesting to talk about how the works we choose either to one of us satisfy that definition and maybe not to the other one. And because I do think that, I mean, taste is always subjective.
Right.
And so the joy of taste is comparing them.
Yeah.
Because like the concept of objective taste is a bad idea.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think that upper middle brow can, as a show concept, can describe the art that we are considering. And I use the term art in a very broad sense, in sort of the same way that people might say cultural production. So it could describe that, but I also think it could potentially describe our orientation towards that art. And so I'm not sure I would consider this novel upper middle brow either, although there are certainly moments that I reach for one, and I'm going to share an example with you momentarily as an answer to your question. I think, though, identifying Stevenson as upper middle brow and then rigorously pulling at various threads, including his bibliography, is a kind of upper middle brow exercise, you know, trying to kind of understand Stevenson's journey as the craftsman he emerged as, and exploring something that's in the midst of that process, to me feels very upper middle brow, whether the work stands up to that quality or not. And so I'm thinking maybe upper middle brow is a definition that will evolve over time. And we haven't even formally picked it as our show title, although it's by far the leading candidate, I would say, right now. And then in terms of something that I found really wonderful, I remember this passage the first time I read the book, which was probably 7 years ago or so. And it also jumped out. And this is, I think, great writing. And so this is a section in the third chapter where ST has gone, in my edition, it's on page 30. ST has gone to a marina, and most of the boats there are kind of fancy yachts, and he's pulled up in a Zodiac, which is and then he gives a loving description of the Zodiac. And I'll skip most of that description, but you need to know that it's an inflatable raft upon which you can put a very large engine, and then it achieves the performance of a much more elegantly built and expensive boat. We had a 40 horse on this puppy, a donation. He's referring to a big engine. We had a 40 horse on this puppy, a donation, and I never dared to throttle it up past 25% of maximum. Remember that a VW Bug has an engine with less than 30 horsepower. When you hit running speed in this Zode, if the water's not too rough, the entire boat rises from the water. The only wet part is the screw. It's the ultimate Boston transportation. On land, there's the Omni, but all these slow cars get in the way. There's public transit, the T, but if you're in good shape, it's usually faster to walk. Bicycles aren't bad, but on water, nothing stops you, and there isn't anything important in Boston that isn't within 2 blocks of being wet. The harbor and the city are interlocked like wrestling squid, tentacles of water and land snaking off everywhere, slashed with bridges or canals. Contrary to what every bonehead believes, the land surface has been stretched out and expanded by civilization. Look at any downtown city. What would be a tiny distance on a backpacking trip becomes a transcontinental journey. You spend hours traveling just a few miles. Your mental map of the city grows and stretches until things seem far away. But get on that Zodiac and the map snaps back into place like a rubber sheet that has been pulled out of shape. Want to go to the airport? Zip. It's right over there. Want to cross the river? Okay, here we are. Want to get from the Common to BU 2 miles away during rush hour right before a playoff game at Fenway Park? Most people wouldn't even try. On a Zodiac, it's just 2 miles. 5 minutes. The real distance. The distance of nature. I'm no stoned out nature head with a 12-string guitar, but that's a fact. I love it. You know, I love that section. And I think it's great, snappy writing. I think it's very similar writing to the first two chapters of Snow Crash. Like it's close cousins with his description of the Deliverator's, you know, car. You know, you want to talk about surface area, da 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 da. It's got that same snappy prose, but it's also got something that I think, apart from Stevenson being a great writer, is one of the things I love about Stevenson as a writer, which is his obsession with infrastructure and of layers between layers and of different layers of reality. And before that section, there's another sentence. I'll try to go back and find it. So he's talking about getting in the Zodiac. He says he's up at the marina, you know, sort of at land level. The tide was out, so I had to use the rope ladder. I had to use the rope ladder to get down into the Zodiac. As soon as you drop below the level of the pier, the city and the sun disappear and you're dangling in a jungle of algae-covered pilings like Tarzan sliding down a vine into a swamp. And then he starts describing the Zodiac. But just that idea, and you have the same thing in Snow Crash with the tunnels under the black sun and also just the metaverse in general. And you have that idea comes up in other Stevenson novels in a really interesting way. And I think one of the things I love about Stevenson is that his novels and his characters are often, they're trying to see the hidden layers. They're trying to sense the world behind the other world, and they're hackers, and the Zodiac is a hack, right? They're trying to use that infrastructure the same way that Hero plunges his sword, you know, through the wall in the metaverse as a hack to kind of like get into a place he's not supposed to go. ST is using the Zodiac to go places and sees things that he's not supposed to see. And I just love that. And even though what follows is kind of a clumsily plotted adventure novel, that pulls me along. And I think, you know, even, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say this is upper middle brow, but that premise and the way the Zodiac works that way, and even the fact that he had the presence of mind to name the novel Zodiac for a few other reasons, I love that.
Yeah, it's a redolent title, not just for what he uses it for, but it's one of the touches in the book that elevates it beyond its kind of like local plot. You know, because like when we're talking about Zodiac, we're also talking about the future and the past and galaxies and constellations and calendars and all of the stuff that is really important. That's a great observation that like minutia is crucial for Stevenson. I'm thinking of all of the highways in Snow Crash that are now run by two competing corporations. And right. You just get this sense that they're freeways they're not freeways, of course, because now you have to like pay for them. But they're sort of snaking everywhere and navigating. You make a choice. One of them gets you there quicker, but the other one emphasizes the comfort of the process.
Yeah.
And I mean that just that image of the harbor and the city are interlocked like wrestling squid.
Yeah.
Is marvelous in it's one of those where you get so much distance from a plural noun that doesn't have an S attached to it. I mean, it's just such a funny sentence, you know, interlocked like wrestling squid. And your brain does that thing that it's supposed to do with metaphor where it's like it sort of throws it out for a second and then begins to consider it. Mm. I do think this book is at its best when it's doing rhapsody. Yeah. And Sangamon Taylor is best when he is rhapsodic. And he is sort of at his worst and his most cynical, and I think sort of like one of the uglier elements of the book when he's just kind of being a dude.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, you know, one of another writer who I don't believe has read, but I've read extensively, who to me is sort of right on the cusp of upper middle brow, is John Scalzi. And I consider Scalzi to be really, really good at dialogue and almost like a kind of master of dialogue in the way that some of the Hollywood screenwriters of like the 30s, like a Mankiewicz, you know, or Frank Capra, you know, that kind of snappy dialogue. And like often men and sometimes women talking to each other in a way that no human actually talks to each other. Like, it's way too clever. It's kind of like Aaron Sorkin. Like, nobody is that snappy. But, you know, Sangamon will, he always has a snapback to whatever some suit is trying to tell him or some cop is trying to tell him or something like that. And it's always clever. And Scalzi does that same thing. And I will say I enjoy that, too. So I'm curious if that's what you mean by him being kind of a bro, or if you're referring more to the like more, the huffing of the nitrous. And
It's more like one of I have a thought experiment for later on that'll reveal some of that. But yeah, there's some of his, and maybe this is intentional because we do get to see ST growing up a little bit the same way that we see Hero grow up over the course of Snow Crash. But you know, part of me wonders, and because there are a lot of visual parallels, like we know Neal Stephenson has a penchant for cigars and so does Sangamon Taylor. There's just something about his particular dude in his 20s obliviousness that drives me a little nuts. But that doesn't happen when he is alone and navigating the Zodiac through the harbor and observing things.
Yeah.
I think those are the moments that reach towards upper for me. It's funny. I mean, like at its best, this book is like this weird mashup of like Raymond Chandler and Edward Abbey.
Yeah.
It's just a very strange, which is great. Like, again, I think one of the things that we'll probably keep bumping into is voicing criticism and then being like, I would kill to be able to write like this.
Well, and you mentioned Edward Abbey, and you know, it's interesting because I believe even the some places list the subtitle as Zodiac, the eco thriller, which made me think. So I believe Stevenson called it an eco thriller. And I thought about it. And I was like, are there any other? Is that a genre? And it's interesting, too, because I think this book is set in the present of when it was written. But it does kind of feel like a sci-fi book for certain because of, I think, an interest in science and technology, and also because a slight lack of implausibility in some of the plotting too, just like some of the heists and the whole Zodiac thing just feel a little bit too neat and perfect to work quite as well as the way that they are described. It feels like it's happening a little bit in sort of fantasy land where, like, you know, a fast talking guy can outsmart cops, lawyers, and security guards in a way that just feels a little too inconsistent. But I guess what I was going with is like, is there any DNA in terms of eco thriller other than, you know, Edward Abbey's Monkey Wrench Gang and the sequel Hey Duke Lives? Those are the only things I can think of where there are protagonists, you know, sort of engaged in similar kind of eco heists, you know. Mm.
Ken Kesey's Sailor Song.
Mm. I like that book.
There is definitely some of that in there. It is. I read it 30 years ago, so it's a long way back there. But I do think there is some of that eco. I think there is a thread of that. But you're right. It is a. This is a genre of 10 books.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe.
You know, Ned, you mentioned Kesey. I think sometimes a great notion, well, it's not really, you have, there is environmental exploitation happening and there's a certain ambivalence about it, but it's not really about trying to stop that. It's more like the competition between the two logging families. Yeah. And the kind of hippie caught in between all of that.
Well, this kind of leads into my next question. So one of the things that I found most helpful about when I got the chance to go to writing school, and then the other like writers that I have worked with and workshopped with over the years, is this concept of like, what are the hot spots? Like, what are the moments, like if you were workshopping this book and Neal Stephenson had brought you this manuscript, and the whole concept of a hotspot is you're like, this has to make it into the book. I can't quite tell you why, but all of a sudden the writing came to life, and maybe it was just that section that you read. But usually it comes up when talking about plot, because it's a moment where you're like, oh, like this is really thrusting the action forward, and now I'm really interested. And my question on this one is, are there hot spots that really made you sit up and take notice, where you suddenly perked up more if you were listening, or if you were reading, were paying closer attention?
Well, yeah, I think so. And what I'm thinking about too is my sense in the first half of this book is that you could probably cut out about 5 chapters worth of material and still tell the same basic story effectively. But I don't know that you would take out literally 5 chapters, because one of the things Stevenson's doing is he's introducing characters and bringing in plot points in ways that are not always well signified. And so it's like, yeah, you meet that lawyer Cohen and he becomes important later, or my trivia question for you later is one of these, but even just sort of the, like, you know, dioxins in the lobster, or you have the sense that there are all these plot points that are sort of adding up to a mystery that's going to get solved in the second half of the book. And you're going to figure out who's responsible for the dioxins and who the Satanists are working for. But I guess I would say I did enjoy just the sort of Blue Kills heist in general. I wonder if like a lot of what we learned in the first 5 chapters couldn't be folded into that heist. Like, could you basically start it in Blue Kills? You know, do you really need, I'm Sangamon Taylor, I ride around in the Zodiac, you know, I mean,
I like nitrous oxide.
I like nitrous, you know, I live with a bunch of misfits on the largest plot of land in, you know, Medford or wherever he's supposed to be. Or
molecules are bullshit.
Yeah. Molecules, Sangamon's rule, all of that. Yeah. So I liked that heist. Obviously, the part I read to you, I like a lot, but you could have it somewhere else, you know?
Yes.
You could have it after he comes back from Blue Kills and he's tooling around the harbor.
You could start the book with that passage.
You probably could, yeah.
You really could start the book with that passage.
Yeah. Yeah, and then he could also say, the Toxicator doesn't take any shit. He carries around a bag of nitrous oxide and a chrome-plated gun that he took off some Satanists one time.
But I could see that as a very effective.
Yeah, you could start. I do like the Spectacle Island adventure. There's just something about the flair and the Satanists and, you know, the poison boysen and Artemis, the Zodiac queen, towing their, you know, expensive boat out. And just like, so that stuck with me. Yeah, and I think I'm up in the air about the Buffalo Niagara adventure. It was entertaining to read, and I think I always enjoy hearing Sangamon Taylor's sort of like, yeah, so we plugged it with epoxy, and then on top of the epoxy we put some concrete, and then over the concrete we broke the heads off the screws, and then we parked the truck on top of that. I love his technical explanations of all the sabotage, and then we used a couple Krypton lights there, and we also got out the official city map showing that we were allowed to park there, and I don't know, that stuff, I'm just a sucker for all of that stuff. It feels a lot like the kind of thoughts I have when I'm fixing my home, which is like, I could probably just... In fact, I do enjoy his meditation on and his colloquy on the hardware store. And all of that. So I think those are the hot spots I just named. Blue Kills, Spectacle Island, the buffalo adventure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mine were, him diving for the PCB sample. Mm. And just that like sort of quiet, like he really hit that kind of feeling of scuba diving in the dark. Mm. And it's sort of wonderfully meditative. And then he also goes on this like long, wonderful, somewhat alarming rant about condom recycling.
Very, very, very Stevenson. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I can't,
yeah, we just dried them off, hung them up on brooms, dusted them with
broomsticks. I can't think of broomsticks differently now. I'm like, oh, it's a perfect condom drying device. Also, yeah. How many broomsticks? Like,
yeah, you would need a lot of broomsticks.
But that one, and then, you know, where the whole scene where Tanya discovers the PCBs and he goes to the lab and sort of sorts out the graffiti timeline, that, okay, like the graffitiist was here after Tanya left. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she has sort of run home, just very like, there's a moment when it does sound a little bit like she's been raped. And really it's sort of, she's kind of lost her like organic, innocence.
Yeah.
And that moment that was like that's the hot spot for me of the first third of the book, because I do think that is the moment that initiates the big plot forward, and it is going to provide us the fuel for Sangamong to get his first, pride brought low. Which is going to be, I think, an important character development throughout. But that was the hottest spot of the book for me. That was different than, oh, I'm enjoying the verve of this heist.
Yeah, and it's his description of sort of how he can kind of shrug off the dioxin poisoning. And how, I can't remember if it's dioxin or PCBs or if they're the same thing or not, and how she can't because they're different kinds of environmentalists. That kind of rang true for me too. Also, you know, sort of given the places where you and I have worked and encountering people more like her, and people, I'm a little bit more like ST in that, you know, like, it's probably going to be all right. You know, I'm not going to worry too much. And I mean, even she gets to the point of realizing that she would have to ingest the chemical for it to really harm her, which, you know, it's not an airborne toxic event.
Do you know that you just quoted Don DeLillo's White Noise?
Yeah, that was conscious. Yeah, okay. It's not an airborne. I was going to say airborne toxin, and then I substituted that then for airborne toxic.
Oh, no,
event.
I know what this could be.
Right.
No, they're no longer calling it that. Now it's the airborne toxic event. I think that is my single most loved moment of that book.
Yeah. There's a band called Airborne Toxic Event now, too. Oh. Yeah. Perfect. I do. I mean, I think in the same way that Stevenson and Chabon might be cousins, I think Stevenson and DeLillo might be second cousins.
Yeah. Yeah. They might orbit the same star, but they're different. They do so at different distances.
Right. That would make them different planets.
True. you have an observation about hacking. Was that a similar one that you?
I already made that when I read the Zodiac chapter. But it is. Yeah, I think it's just something I noticed. And you also get this with chemistry, and you also get this with, I mean, the Zodiac is a hack, right? That it's a way of getting around a congested American city much more quickly, and also kind of Stevenson suggests seeing a hidden layer of reality that most people aren't aware of, which is what hackers do. And, you know, there's also a similar moment when he goes to the hardware store and figures out how he's going to plug the diffuser. And that's very much a hack in a sense, too, because he's not using any of the things that he purchases for their intended use, you know, except for maybe the wing nuts.
You know, from talking about this before, you have a personal affection for this own possible use of a Zodiac that I think you should bring
up. Yeah, no, and I read this when I had recently moved to Chicago, you know, and I was actually really frustrated because I lived on a transit line that got me downtown. It was about a 5-7 minute walk to the stop, and I could time it, get on the train, and I'd be downtown in 15 minutes or less. And my office was downtown, but the office is in Navy Pier, which is actually a solid like half hour bus trip or roughly mile and a half walk from where I was let off. And this was in the dead of winter too. So it was very, very, very cold. And so my commute could take 45, 50 an hour by train. And I found that really frustrating because the distance wasn't that far. And because I had a train that got me like 90% of the way there. And I also noted at the time that I lived less than a mile from the South Branch of the Chicago River, and that, you know, the Navy Pier is on the lake and the river goes right to the lake. And I was very jealous of Sangamon Taylor, his ability to zip around Boston, because, you know, with a Zodiac, I could have gotten to work in about 10 minutes. And, you know, I spent hours and hours and hours on lurchy pink line trains, feeling a little bit seasick, a little bit claustrophobic, you know, and then figuring out, like, am I going to just huff it and walk really quickly to Navy Pier, or do I take the bus? And so I remember being very jealous of ST's hack of using the Zodiac as a way of getting around. And I still like have a dream of someday living in a coastal city and getting around by boat. I feel like that would be splendid. And there's not enough of that in America.
You need to, if you have your notebook nearby, you need to write down the phrase lurchy pink line train. That's a perfect, just drop that into whatever's next.
All right. I can remember that. Yeah.
So why don't you give us a reading about Dorkin?
Okay. Well, this is another reading. Another observation I have, in the same way that ST is sort of bad at relationships, I also think that at least young Neal Stephenson is not good at foreshadowing romance. It's a little bit better with what's the hero's paramour?
Juanita.
It's a little bit better because we meet Juanita pretty early and you get the sense that Hero has a crush on her pretty early on. But Debbie is not a super well-developed character when this particular passage happens. And so Debbie, we've met her in an earlier chapter, but she's actually a pretty major logistical supporter of the Blue Kills heist. And so she and ST are working on a lot of stuff together. And at one point they're driving around the Omni van, and ST is sort of gently chiding her for not checking the oil dipstick. And she's like, come on, is that really important? And he starts talking about how the problem with the collective ownership of this car is that nobody takes care of it. So he says, I opened up the back and took out a couple cans of oil. You ever read The Tragedy of the Commons? Environmental piece, I know that. Any property that's open to common use gets destroyed because everyone has an incentive to use it to the max, but no one has incentive to maintain it, like the water and the air. These guys have incentive to pollute the ocean, but no reason to clean it up. It's the same deal with this. Okay, I can make the connection. Putting oil into the Omni is another form of environmentalism. I shoved the oil spout into the can, immediately making a sexual connection in my own mind. Then I poked the spout into the proper hole on the Omni and looked at her, smearing the oil around on my fingers. She was looking at me. The travelodge maid barged in and found us dorking each other's brains out on the rug, right in front of the door. Above us, Debbie was being interviewed on the telly. For some reason, we had turned on all the hot water taps in the bathroom and the place was boiling with steam. Debbie's interview and her other sound effects from below were half drowned out by the buzz of the magic fingers. She slammed the door on her way out. What the hell did they expect? Giving us the honeymoon suite. If you're planning to stay more than one day, it's traditional to inform the hotel, I said when we were finished. Debbie didn't answer because she was laughing too hard. So, I don't know. It's funny. It's also very sudden, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't believe there's been any foreshadowing whatsoever that that ST finds Debbie particularly attractive or interesting. And, you know, later throughout the book, we have the sense that he actually does like her and wants to continue and finds her attractive and wants to continue his relationship with her, but is also very bad at communicating that to her or admitting it to himself. And he kind of knows that he's bad at it, but also doesn't seem to be able to do anything about it. But it's also just something, I think this is a thing you get throughout Stevenson, which is just like sudden awareness of romantic attraction without it being foreshadowed. And to me, this was a rather extreme example of it.
Yeah. Yeah. In my,
fun visual of the rug. Oh, yeah. And the
it's great. The rug, there's a real Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas vibe to that section, especially we had left all the hot water taps on for some reason.
And right.
Like that could have been pulled from the pages of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is great. Like again, he's at his best when he is like verve is just a word that I keep coming back to with Stevenson. And this is, that is a very vervacious, if also like, you know, a little myopic section. But again, we got to consider the source and the time.
I'm also remembering that there's a moment where Hero is putting on his virtual reality goggles and he finds that erotic too.
Yeah.
And again, it's like these are young men we're talking about. And Stevenson seems to be suggesting that young men have a capacity for finding quite a few things erotic.
Totally. So I'm gonna take us to our trivia, because my question jumps off of from what you were just talking about.
Okay. We might have the same trivia question.
Maybe. We'll see. Can you name for me the female characters from the first 19 chapters of the book and what, if anything, they add to the plot?
Well, I mostly listen to the book, although, and so it's harder for me to remember names when I don't do that. Obviously, there's Debbie, the romantic interest.
Yep.
There's the name. I hope you'll just give me credit for the poisoned lady, whose name I don't remember, but we said it earlier in this.
We did. Tanya.
It's a name like Debbie. There is the librarian. Whose name I don't remember. It's something like Ophelia.
I think it's Esmeralda.
Esmeralda, the librarian, who, what does she add to the plot?
She's very helpful. She's a very helpful character.
I think you also get a sense of ST's working style, from his interactions with her. And I mean, and she's also a character who's treated with a certain amount of respect. You know, she's understood to be the master of her domain, you know, and part of why we understand that ST is good at his job is that he has figured that out about her and has figured out how to stay on her good side by sending, you know, flowers and turtles, I believe, or, chocolate, treats and, you know, being charming. And she seems to sort of enjoy him as a kind of spunky young guy who likes old maps and things like that. Let's see, other women in this book. There is the screamer, his roommate's girlfriend, who is the second loudest copulator. I think she is only in the book for texture. There, let's see, other women in the book. Artemis, the Zodiac driver, who is a pretty fun, like, eco-activist badass, I think also in there for texture, although she does just, like, randomly end up dorking the reporter who comes along in a way that feels like it's just everybody like have sex whenever nobody's looking in this community. Is that just like anytime you're alone with somebody who you might be attracted to? Who else? There's the female roommate whose name I don't remember, who I think she exists to kind of scold the 20 something men who huff nitrous and don't, you know, keep the house in a very good state. I think she does exist to kind of as a foil to ST's kind of slovenly lifestyle and his lack of maturity. trying to think if there's anybody else, anybody associated with, there's some, a few other like divers and G sorts, some of whom might be women whose names aren't leaking out to me. I think that's all I can think of right now.
You got everybody except Rebecca, the reporter.
Oh, Rebecca. Who is the one who you would think that ST would have ended up dorking in a hotel room?
Because he had dorked her at one point with a casual offhanded, we'd been in the sack a few times. And the reminder that we wouldn't in the future made her 100,000, excuse me, at least twice as beautiful.
Right. That was a clever callback to his.
It was a clever callback. But still, my issue here is that that the women in this book, if they fulfill either wildly stereotypical roles of librarian, and the only one who really gets to be something other than, like, I need a female foil. I need a previous love interest. I need a current love interest. The only one who gets to kind of be a badass is Artemis.
Yeah.
Really none of the characters except ST are really drawn with really any kind of depth to them in this book. But I think that particular like extended blind spot is a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, I also, when I reread that Rebecca section, I was like, this is Juanita beta version. Do you know? I mean, it's like their first encounter. If you go back and read Hero's first encounter with Juanita, it's like almost the same conversation. We used to have sex, and you know, the protagonist is still attracted to this woman, and she has some information that she wants him to understand, but she's also kind of milking him for information too. And they have a kind of flirty transactional relationship. It's a very similar, and you would sort of expect that to grow, and it doesn't really go anywhere except for, I think, Rebecca pops up at another point for plot reasons. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. You know, I think maybe with Artemis, he's trying a little bit. And I think with YT in Snow Crash, he tries a little harder. And this is something that Stevenson is certainly, I think has gotten better at over the years.
Yeah, because I mean, YT alone becomes, I think, the best character of Snow Crash. So, you know, kudos to him for continuing to make that effort. But okay, your turn.
All right. Well, actually, this ties in very well with your question. Because, you know, when I read the dorking passage the first time, I was like, wait, who's Debbie again? And I got curious as to like how much, you know, back plot there had been with Debbie. So Debbie does appear in chapter 2 doing something. Can you remember what she's doing in chapter 2?
Oh my without God, looking it chapter up? 2. Okay, I know chapter 2 is the chapter where they go and save the van. Where they, because Wyman is an idiot, but she doesn't come along to save the van because the former renter cop Gomez comes along to save the van. So I think it's an interaction at G headquarters. Oh. I need a hint.
It's not at the headquarters.
Oh.
Is
it after they save the van?
I don't remember. But it's not involved with the van incident.
I don't know. I can't remember. This is one of my problems, is I was like, Debbie? I was when did that start?
I don't think it's your problem. I mean, I think I'll give you a hint. It is in one of the kind of, there are some sort of like, as ST's sort of explaining who he is and what he gets up to, he describes some of his early heists or sort of early stunts. It's involved with one of those.
I don't don't have it. It's not there.
So there's an early heist where he's discovered some pollution and he's trying to get the attention of some politician. I think it was like a congressman or like a minister in a building, and this person won't meet with him. So he dresses up like Santa Claus and marches past security and gets to this person's office. And Debbie at the time is an intern and she is one of Santa's elves.
That's awesome. Okay.
I went back. I was like, I went back through the book and was like reading through and I was like, oh, Debbie. And there, it lists another woman intern who might have been Tanya or it might have been someone else. The other thing is, in our list of women, we're forgetting the kind of Money Penny like secretary too, who, to your point, reads ST's mail. And it's kind of messages.
Of an annoying shrew.
And flirts. Although as far as we know, ST has not been in the sack with her, although she seems available.
Listeners, as you can imagine, next up we are going to be considering part two of Neal Stephenson's Zodiac, an eco thriller, chapters 19 all the way to the end.
Thank you so much for listening to us once again. If you haven't listened to the first four episodes, go check the podcast feed for those. And we would love it if you left us a nice, friendly, positive rating and review. If you have negative things to say, you're welcome to send us an email and give us your constructive criticism. You can send it to jpd@uppermiddlebrow.com or...
BAGG at uppermiddlebrow.com.
Bag? That's a funny name.
It sure is, but you'll never forget it.
And with that, we bid you good night.
Good night, everybody.
Okay, Duke's here. I'm back in Chicago on the chilly back porch. Chicago, the city of big shoulders and loud mufflers, as I bet you'll hear. And before I let you go, we got some fresh reviews to read. Remember, if you leave us a review, we'll read the first 10 or so. And we have two. The first one is from Surfeit of Justice. It's called Wit, Charm, and Insight in Spades. As a proud and very fortunate beta listener, I got early access to the first few episodes, and listeners, you are in for a treat. Chris and Jesse are funny, thoughtful, and insightful, and I suspect they will keep us laughing and thinking about books and life for many months to come. You'll discover new books as you read along with them, you'll revisit some of your favorites, and read them again with fresh eyes and new friends. A must-listen for book lovers of all stripes. I believe Surfeit of Justice is our friend Justin, who you're actually going to hear on an upcoming episode. We're going to be talking about The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson, and Justin's going to talk about the depiction of education technology and pedagogy in that book. So that's coming up in a few weeks. Next review, titled Thoughtful Discussion of Books by Great Storytellers by Jenny G. in Bend. If you're looking for a refresher slash recap of a book plot followed by wide-spanning discussion of themes, impacts to culture, and character development, this is the podcast for you. Since Snow Crash is one of my favorite books, I loved Dukes and Bag taking me through the plot after a few years since my last reread. Analysis in light of society today and our changing norms was also much appreciated. Cherries on top, both hosts have excellent podcast host voices and are vivid storytellers. I feel like I'm riding along with them when they share stories of their first reads of books, even if that was a few decades ago. Well, thank you, Jenny G. Obviously, you have excellent taste in podcast host voices. Upper Middlebrow is a small point production. Jesse Dukes and Chris Bagg are the boat captains, Zodiac drivers, and scuba divers. Music by Ben Pajak and Jesse Dukes. Graphic design and website by the multi-talented Christopher K. Bagg. See you out there, folks.